Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Numbers chapter 10. I'm going to do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 36, setting out from Mount Sinai. Finally, we're leaving Mount Sinai, and the children of Israel are getting ready to start their adventures in the desert. Our context is this, in Numbers 9, verses 1 through 23. We saw the first Passover since leaving Egypt, celebrated at Mount Sinai, and we saw the Shekinah glory settling over the tabernacle. And so now we're ready to start Numbers 10, verses 1 through 4. The Lord spoke further to Moses, saying, "Make yourself two trumpets of silver, of hammered work you shall make them, and you shall use them for summoning the congregation and for having the camps set out. When both are blown, all the congregation shall gather themselves to you at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Yet if only one is blown, then the leaders, the heads of the divisions of Israel, shall assemble before you." Verse 1, the Lord spoke further to Moses. Remember, God is constantly speaking to Moses. Moses is at the doorway of the tent of meeting, and most probably is, and the Shekinah glory, God is speaking through the wings of the cherubim on top of the ark, as we see over and over and over through Leviticus and Numbers. Verse 2, "Make yourself two trumpets of silver," God tells Moses. Now, this is probably done at public expense, not Moses' expense, because silver trumpets, very, very expensive, as John Gill points out. And it's two of them, not just one. Why are there two? There's one for each of Aaron's two sons, Eleazar and Ithamar, the two surviving sons of Aaron the high priest. They were to blow the trumpets, as we see in verse 8, which I'll read, Numbers 10. "The sons of Aaron the priest are to sound the trumpets. Your use of these is a permanent statute throughout your generations." Well, the priests that are alive now are Eleazar and Ithamar. Those are the high priests. Well, in Numbers 10:8 says the sons of Aaron, the priest. It doesn't say the high priest. It just says the priest. Well, Eleazar and Ithamar are just ordinary priests now. They eventually became high priests, but Aaron's the high priest now, and Eleazar and Ithamar are common priests, and they were the ones that were to blow those two trumpets. Now, later on, in Joshua's time, after the Exodus, there were seven ram's horns, not two silver trumpets, but seven ram's horns, which were trumpets. Joshua 6:4, "Also seven priests shall carry seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark." This is around Jericho, the famous story when the walls of Jericho fell. "Then on the seventh day you shall march around the city seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets." So there's seven of them then. And later on, the trumpets were increased in number even more. 2 Chronicles 5:12, "And all the Levitical singers, Asaph, Heman, Jeduthun, and their sons and kinsmen, clothed in fine linen with cymbals, harps, and lyres, standing east of the altar, and with them 120 priests blowing trumpets." So that was been quite a spectacle. Now, why was it necessary to blow trumpets here? The trumpets are to be blown for summoning the congregation, because remember, there's 2 million people, and they're spread out all over a large place. But it's not hard to see that the sound could carry that far. As Jomison, Fawcett, and Brown says, "The sound is conveyed easily through the pure atmosphere and reverberated strongly among the valleys of the Sinaitic hills." We know from Josephus his description of these trumpets, and also the pictures of the trumpets on the Arch of Titus in Rome, right across from the Colosseum there. We know that, of course, the Arch of Titus was a celebration of the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, so he had pictures of a bunch of Jewish stuff that he had conquered and taken back to Rome. So from that picture, we know that the trumpets were straight and long and thin. Now in verse 3, God tells Moses, "When both are blown, both of those silver trumpets are blown, all the congregation shall gather." Well, the first question you have is, how can 2 million people gather in front of the door of the tabernacle? That's absurd. Well, the pulpit commentary says, no, not all of them individually, but they gathered by their natural or customary representatives. But that presents another problem is, in verse 4, we see a different situation where only one trumpet is blown, then the leaders of Israel come together, the heads of the divisions of Israel. How do you distinguish that? Well, this is the way I do it. I couldn't find any commentator. Of course, that's what always happens. You want something, some advice on something, and the commentators say nothing. But this is the way I distinguish it, is that in verse 3, it's talking about not only the tribal leaders, but the clan leaders within a tribe, and also families within clans. So you're talking about a larger group of people than just the 12 tribal leaders. They gather with one, when two blasts of the trumpet are blown. And then in verse 4, if only one blast is blown, Moses is saying, I just need to talk to the 12 tribal leaders, whose names have been listed out four times here in Numbers. I haven't read them out yet, because you're not going to remember them. But one blast, those 12 tribal leaders come together. Now, I'm mentioning here the use of trumpets to gather the people of Israel, to assemble them, but there were three other uses: to get them ready to march, to get them in marching order. The third use of trumpets is to call them to battle and prepare to war. And the fourth use of trumpets was to gather the people for the famous festivals, the three famous festivals and other festivals. Now, let me read you a quote from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown about the blowing of these trumpets. It doesn't say how they're blown. It just says they're blown. When both are blown or one is blown. Some people say both could be blown together in one blast. Well, that means that the Israelites would have to distinguish a loud blast from a single blast. I don't think that's what it is. I think the two are blown in succession. Bop, bop. And then all the leaders come before the door of the tabernacle. But then if one is blown, bump, that's it. No subsequent blast. Then the tribal leaders come before the door of the tabernacle. The heads of the divisions of Israel, it says in verse 4, I'm going to assume that's the tribal leaders, the 12 of them. Now, as I said, these trumpet blasts are not described as far as to how they were blown. Was it bonk or was it bonk, 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 bonk? You know, who knows? Now, this is what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown speculate. There seem to have been signals made by a difference in the loudness and variety in the notes, suited for different occasions in which the Israelites learned to distinguish. A simple uniform sound by both trumpets summoned a general assembly of the people. That would be bonk. Bump. The blast of a single trumpet convoked the princes to consult on public affairs. That would be bump. Notes of some other kind were made to sound an alarm, whether for journeying or for war. That might be like da 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 da. Just speculating. One alarm was the recognized signal for the eastern division of the camp. That's Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun to march. Two alarms give the signal for the southern to move. We'll see that in the next verse. And though it is not present in our present Hebrew text, the Septuagint has that on three alarms being sounded, those on the west would march, and then while four blasts, those on the north decamped. Thus, the greatest order and discipline were established in the Israelitish camp. No military march could be better regulated. Well, now let's talk about setting the camps out, the triads, the four triads, a triad consisting of three tribes. They had to set out in military order. The Masoretic text, which we're using here, tells you about the north and the south. I don't know why it didn't end up in the, or why the Septuagint has the west and the north. Why the Septuagint has those two situations, I don't know. But anyway, let me read this. Numbers 10, 5 through 10. But when you blow an alarm, the camps that are pitched on the east side shall set out. And of course, that's Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. When you blow an alarm the second time, the camps that are pitched on the south side shall set out. That's Reuben, Simeon, and Gad. They take out next. Now, when it says you blow an alarm the second time, Clark says it goes like this. The first alarm is bonk, and the second alarm is bonk, bonk. And that makes sense to me, because it would be easier for the tribes to distinguish the blast. They wouldn't have to worry about losing count. Was that the first blast or the second blast? All right, there's the south side triad heading out. Verse 7, when convening the assembly hour, you shall blow without sounding an alarm. That means you blow it a different way, obviously, because you got to distinguish the blast for getting ready to march and the blast for just assembling together to listen to Moses. Verse 8, the priestly sons of Aaron, moreover, shall blow the trumpets. And, of course, those are Eleazar and Ithamar to start with. And eventually all the priestly sons of Aaron, they're the ones in charge of blowing the silver trumpets. And this shall be for you a perpetual statute throughout your generations. Oh, but I don't have to mention anymore that perpetual just means until the Old Testament covenant. The Old Testament law is finished. After that, in the New Covenant, there is not a statute to blow trumpets. That's over with. Verse 9, when you go to war in your land against the adversary who attacks you, then you shall sound an alarm with the trumpets, that you may be remembered before the Lord your God and be saved from your enemy. So there's the third use of the trumpets. First use is to assemble the people. The second use is to prepare the people for march. The third use is to prepare the people for war. Verse 10, also in the day of your gladness and in your appointed feast and on the first days of your months, that's every first month, every first day of the month was a feast of trumpets. They would blow trumpets. You shall blow the trumpets over your burnt offerings and over the sacrifices of your peace offerings, and this shall be a reminder of you before your God. Now, I'm assuming that blowing the trumpets over the burnt offerings and the peace offerings are the burnt offerings and peace offerings of the festivals. Not every time they had a peace offering or a burnt offering, they'd be blowing the trumpets all day long and drive everybody crazy. In verse 5, God says, when you blow an alarm, Adam Clark says the Hebrew word for alarm probably means short, broken, sharp tones terminating with long ones. In other words, bah, 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 bah. I don't know how he gets that out of the Hebrew. He's a polymath. I'll take his word for it. Now notice that who could blow these trumpets? Only the sons of Aaron. That means the priest only, not the Levites. In verse 10, the trumpets are to be blown for feast. The NIV Study Bible says these trumpets were blown to prepare people for communion with God, which was the purpose of these feasts. David later expanded the trumpets to a full orchestra in 1 Chronicles 25. But even so, he still maintained the blowing of the two silver trumpets. I wonder if the extra trumpets were not silver. That's pretty expensive. And David also regularly blew trumpets before the Ark of the Covenant, 1 Chronicles 16:6, and Benaiah and Jehaziel, the priest, blew trumpets continually before the Ark of the Covenant of God. I assume that's while it's moving. Some of the feasts that the trumpets were blown at, Passover, Pentecost, Feast of Tabernacles, or the Ingathering, or the Feast of Booths, those three are the basic feasts of Israel, also the Feast of Trumpets in Tishri 1, also the first of every month, as we said. In fact, Psalm 81:3 says this, blow the horn on the day of our feast, during the new moon and during the full moon. They were to blow the trumpet at the beginning of the month, and the new moon, and during the full moon at the end of the month. 2 Chronicles 29:27 says this, then Hezekiah, and this occurred at the renewal of temple worship when he got the temple set up again, Hezekiah gave the order to offer the burnt offering on the altar. When the burnt offering began, the song to the Lord also began with the trumpets. So trumpets were a big deal in the liturgy of Israel. We go now to Numbers 10:11-13. Now in the second year, in the second month, on the 20th of the month, the cloud was lifted from over the tabernacle of the testimony, and the sons of Israel set out on their journeys from the wilderness of Sinai. Then the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. So they moved out for the first time according to the commandment of the Lord through Moses. Now verse 11 begins the second great section of the book of Numbers according to the NIV Study Bible. That second section is from this verse, Numbers 10:11 through Numbers 22:1. And this is when they're moving, when they're out moving from Mount Sinai. The first part of the book just had to do with them taking a census, doing a Passover, having the tribal princes give a bunch of offerings to the tabernacle. They were just getting set up and getting ready to go. Now they're in the second month, which is the month of Iyar, the 20th of the month. The New American Standard Bible Study Bible says that in the second month, Iyar, in year 2, since the departure from Egypt, the Israelites have spent approximately 11 months in the Mount Sinai region. Well, John Gill says it's more like 11 months and 20 days. It's close to 12 months. A time reference is given in Exodus 19:1. In the third month after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that very day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. See, it's in the third month. That could be anywhere from day 1 to day 30 of the third month, and so that makes it a little fuzzy. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says it was 11 months and 29 days. Adam Clark says it's 11 months and 20 days. I don't know. We don't know exactly how long, but let's just say roughly a little bit shy of 12 months they've been at Mount Sinai, and now they're getting ready to leave. Now, some chronology here. In the second year, on the first month, which is Nisan 1, that's the tabernacle had been finished by that date. Nisan 14, in the first month of the second year, Nisan 14, they had the first. Well, they had their second Passover. It was the first one at Mount Sinai, the first one in the wilderness. And then in Iyar 1, the census command was given to Moses, and the census was taken a couple of days, I think, to finish that. And then they were somewhere in there after Iyar 1, second month, Iyar 1, in the second year, the 12 tribal leaders presented their offerings, their identical offerings, to the tabernacle. And then in ER 14, they had the makeup Passover for those who were on a journey or who couldn't make the first Passover on Nisan the 14th. And so that was 6 days earlier than this. ER 20, they finished that second Passover. It's time to go. ER 20, second year. Now, they should have made it into Canaan in just a few months, leaving from here. Instead, it took about 39 years. Well, actually, it's 39 years plus, and you got to count the year that they had taken going from Egypt to Israel, so let's say 38 more years plus. Long time. They didn't need to do that, but they sinned and rebelled, and we'll see that very shortly in the next chapter. Now, they were headed for the wilderness of Paran. That's where the cloud settled down, the Shekinah glory cloud leading them on. If you'll look at a map, first of all, in this atlas.org map, which is Everybody uses these maps. They're great. They've got Paran to the north and west of Mount Sinai. Of course, Mount Sinai itself is questioned. People still debate where that is, but the traditional place of Mount Sinai is at the south central part of the Sinai Peninsula, between the two forks of the Red Sea, the Suez Gulf on the west and the Gulf of Aqaba on the east. And if Mount Sinai is there, then you go northwest a little bit and they got Paran with a question mark. However, I like to say it's the wilderness of Paran. So if you look at the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, go up the Araba Rift, the Araba Valley, until you get to the southern tip of the Dead Sea, that's just to orient you. To the west of that valley, that rift, you got two wildernesses. The wilderness of Paran is right north of the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, and the wilderness of Paran is right south of the tip of the Dead Sea. So I'm assuming they went up to the wilderness of Paran, which is right north of the tip of the Dead Sea. And again, all this is controversial about where they went when, but that's just as good a place as any to locate them. They marched for 3 days and camped. Now, Adam Clark says this, quote, "It is extremely difficult to determine these journeys with any degree of exactness, and we're often at a loss to know whether the place in question was in a direct or retrograde position from the place previously mentioned." Now, I just said, people debate till the cows come home on where the Israelites were at a certain time. I've seen a bunch of documentaries on YouTube discussing that weighty question, so unfortunately it's sort of been lost to history. Now we look at Numbers 10, verses 14 through 28, and we talk about the standards of the 12 tribes. There was four standards and 12 tribes. Each triad of tribes had a standard. You have a north triad, a south triad, an east triad, and a west triad. Well, let's go in order here. First of all, verse 14, the standard of the camp of the sons of Judah. All right, so we have a standard. And then we have the leader of the camp of Judah, Nashon. And the same form goes all the way through these 28 verses. I'm not going to read them all to you. Now, each of the four triads of tribes had a banner for rallying and organization. They would look at the banner and the tribes say, oh, there's our banner. Let's go. Judah had a banner. And so Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun would then say, well, let's form up on that standard. Now, Numbers chapter 2 mentions these standards for all the four triads. I'm going to run through them quickly. Numbers 2, 3. Now those who camp on the east side toward the sunrise shall be the standard of the camp of Judah. And of course, Judah was ahead of Issachar and Zebulun. And that's on the east. Now we're going clockwise now to on the south. Numbers 2, 10. On the south side shall be the standard of the camp of Reuben. And when I say south side, I mean south side of the tabernacle, which is being carried by the various Levite families in the center of the whole marching formation. The south side, you got the standard of Reuben, and plus the leader of Reuben, whose name is Eliezer. Then we go clockwise continuing. We're on the west side now, Numbers 2:18. On the west side shall be the standard of the camp of Ephraim. And then the leader of Ephraim was Elishama. Then we go back to the north, still going clockwise, Numbers 2:25. On the north side shall be the standard of the camp of Dan by their armies. And then the leader of Dan was Ahiezer. So, there's your four standards for the four triads of the 12 tribes of Israel. Again, notice the military order and precision that the Israelites marched with. This was absolutely necessary. Otherwise, Moses would be ahead of an undisciplined mob, which they all would have died in the wilderness if they didn't have this military discipline. Now, in this section, verses 14 through 28 of Numbers 10, we have some additional details about the order of march. We got some information about Gershon, Merari, and the Kohathites. Those are the three families of the Levites that were in charge of carrying the ark and its accompanying furniture and coverings and so forth. So let me put it all together and give you the order of march once again, as I did in Numbers 2. First of all, in the front, and the front is east. We're going east. And as if we're at the front of the camp at east and we head west, this is what we see. The Levites are the easternmost position. They were carrying the ark, of course, because God's got to lead the people. And then the first triad, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, is behind the ark. Then behind the first triad, we have the Gershonites and the Merarites carrying the Gershonites carried the curtains of the tabernacle, the four curtains that were laid over the top, plus the doorway to the Holy of Holies they carried. And the Merarites carried the actual structure, the framework, the boards and the planks and the bars that held the planks together. So they were carrying, that came next. And as we head west, going back into the line of march, we have the second triad, Reuben, Simeon, and Gad. Reuben is the standard bearer. We go to the west of Reuben. Simeon and Gad, and we see the Kohathites, and they're carrying the furnishings, the Ark of the Covenant, the bread of the presence table, and the seven-branched candlestick. We go west of the Kohathites, we see the third triad, Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. We go to the west of that third triad, we get to the fourth triad, and Ephraim was the standard bearer of the third triad. And we go to the west of the third triad, we see Dan, Asher, and Naphtali, the fourth triad, and Dan was the standard bearer for that fourth triad. It was appropriate, I didn't mention this, Judah is at the very beginning, right past the ark, right behind the ark. That's appropriate because the Messiah came from Judah. So Judah was leading the march. We go now to Numbers 10:29. Then Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, "We are setting out to the place of which the Lord said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will do you good, for the Lord has promised good concerning Israel." Now Hobab was Moses' brother-in-law, because Reuel had a daughter named Zipporah, and Moses had married Zipporah. And since Hobab is the son of Reuel, even as Zipporah was the son of Reuel, that makes Hobab Moses' son-in-law. Now, when is he there in to see Moses at Mount Sinai? Well, you have to look at a map, and I like this part of the map because I spent a night there one night. It's right at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, which today is at the very tip of modern-day Israel. And so since I was taking a tour of southern Israel, I was allowed to stay there in a hotel at Eilat is the on the Israel side, and Aqaba is the Jewish town on the other side of that tip of the Gulf of Aqaba. Right in that area, if you go over into Jordan and go south of Jordan, you're into Saudi Arabia. In that area, the old maps show that as Midian. And they also show Midian as being in the Sinai Peninsula. So all of that area is where the Midianites lived, and Reuel was a Midianite. And so it makes sense to think that Reuel was just to the east of the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba in present-day Jordan, or present-day Saudi Arabia, in that area on the border of those two modern countries, and that he just hopped on over a short distance to the Sinai Peninsula, right north of the Gulf of Aqaba, and then right down into the Sinai Peninsula and saw Moses, his son-in-law. Makes sense. And, of course, Jethro had done the same thing earlier. He had come before the giving of the law in Exodus 18:5. We read this, Moses' father-in-law Jethro, along with Moses' wife and sons, came to him in the wilderness where he was camped at the mountain of God. So Jethro had already made a trip to see Moses, and Hobab was, it might have come on that same trip, might have come later, but at any rate, he's there, and Moses is asking him a favor. Well, he's actually trying to bribe him. Hey, man, this is the promised land we're going to. We're going to inherit all kinds of land. Think how rich you'll be. How about come with us? Now, why was Moses so interested in that? Well, because Hobab knew the area, and he could help guide them through the area. Now, we need to remember that Reuel is another name for Jethro, who is Moses' father-in-law, Zipporah's dad, Reuel and Jethro. Reuel, a.k.a. Jethro, the same people. Now, Moses is quoting God, and he says, "We are setting out to the place of where the Lord said, I will give it to you." God said to Moses, "I will give it to you." Moses didn't realize at the time that he was not going to be included in that you, because he died before in Moab, at Mount Pisgah, before the Israelites crossed over into the Promised Land. He didn't know that. He might not have sounded so confident talking to Hobab had he known that he wasn't going to be in the number that crossed the Jordan River. Why did he want Hobab to come? Well, he could have just want one of his relatives to enjoy the good things coming, and so he invites Hobab earnestly to come, since Moses is expecting good things from God. That's Clark's idea, but I really don't think so. I think he had utilitarian motives. He wanted some guidance through the wilderness, because Hobab, he's a Midianite. That's his stomping grounds. He would know, and we're just talking about 3 days' march from Mount Sinai, so this is Midianite territory. Moses probably thought that Hobab could help him out. We go to Numbers 10, verse 32. But he said to him, that's Hobab said to Moses, "I will not come, but rather will go to my own land and relatives." Well, so there, Moses. Verse 31, then he said, Moses said, "Please do not leave us, Hobab, inasmuch as you know where we would camp in the wilderness, and you will be his eyes for us." In other words, you will be a guide for us. Verse 32, so it will be if you go with us that whatever good the Lord does for us, he will do for you. We are the promised people. Now, of course, this is before Moses knew what hell they were going to go through for 38 plus years because of the sin and rebellion of the Israelites. He didn't know that yet. But he's just saying, hey, it's a good deal for you, Hobab. Come on. And I need a guide in the wilderness. You're going to be our eyes. But Hobab said, before that, Hobab told Moses, no, I'm not going to go. I'm going to go to my relatives. Now, isn't that interesting? The call of one's natural ties always competes mightily with the call to enter into God's promised land. Any Christian will tell you that. What did Jesus say about hating your mother and father and loving them less than him? The reason he said that is because what he also said to another one, he says, let the dead bury the dead. You want to take care of your family obligations, fine. But first of all, you need to follow me. This is what comes up all the time. Who were my brothers and sisters? Or who were my mother and brothers? He said when one time his family was trying to get him to stop ministering. You got to put the kingdom of God first, and then he'll take care of your relatives. And all of this is interesting that Hobab wants to get back to his relatives, because isn't it true that 99% of life's problems come from one's family? Hobab could have gotten away from it all, headed up into the promised land. Well, at any rate, it doesn't say whether Hobab changed his mind or not, and so the commentators disagree over that. Judges 1:16 indicates that Hobab did agree, finally change his mind, and go with Moses to the promised land. We read in Judges 1:16, the descendants of the Kenite, and the Kenite is Jethro, also known as Reuel. He was a Midianite, but he was also a Kenite. Don't ask me why. The descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up from the city of palms with the sons of Judah to the wilderness of Judah, which is in the south of Arad. I'm not going to get into the geography here. The point is they went up to the promised land. They went and lived with the people, lived with the Israelites. So there we see in Judges 1:16 that Reuel, also known as Jethro's descendants, it doesn't say Hobab by name, but it says his descendants were living with the people. Well, how did the descendants get there to live among the people unless Hobab went? That's a strong indication, even though his name's not mentioned. So John Gill suggests that Hobab probably did change his mind after his initial refusal and going up to the promised land with the Israelites. However, Jameson, Fawcett, Brown disagree with that. They say Hobab went back home into the Midian proper over there in present-day Jordan or Egypt. Now, it's a minor issue whether he went or whether he stayed, but let's look at another problem. Why would Moses need a guide when he had the Shekinah cloud? The Shekinah cloud was guiding them wherever they went. Why does he go to Moab? We need you for our eyes. Well, here's some options to answer that problem. First option, Moses wanted Hobab not for guidance, but rather for advice. For example, how to deal with the tribes in the area, I speculate. Remember, Hobab is not a single individual. He's the prince of a powerful clan, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, and so he would have contacts in the area. Well, that's nice, but I don't think that's the best answer. I think Adam Clark's got the best answer. He says that the Shekinah glory cloud directed the Israelites generally, but not on their particular excursions. The cloud would just say, okay, here, camp here, but now if they got to send out a scouting party, or they got to send out for hunting or food or something, they're not going to know the area. And that Shekinah glory cloud is not going to be precise enough to guide them to where they need to go. Adam Clark said that Israelite parties took several journeys while the grand army lay still, and he gives quotes on that, Numbers 13, 20, 31, and 32, etc. So the Israelites had subunits of that army moving around. They needed guides. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out, in addition to what Clark said, that the cloud would not point out where pasture, shade, and water were. Pasture, shade, and water is often hid by shifting sands. And the Shekinah glory cloud stopping, he might stop them in a good place, but all the Israelites would see was sand. And so then they could go to Hobab and say, where exactly should we camp here? Now, this little rabbit trail shows how God often uses natural means as well as supernatural means to guide his people or to accomplish his purposes. And that is a dichotomy that messes up a lot of Christians' attention, that befuddles a lot of Christians. You have to use natural means in addition to supernatural. Just the other day, I was talking to a Chinese divorced woman who decided she wants to get married. And so she was sitting around her apartment watching romantic soap operas. I said, well, that's not going to get the job done. Why don't you get on eHarmony? She says, no, you know, it's not spiritual enough. I said, well, you hungry. You don't put the chopsticks. You don't put the chopsticks in your mouth when you're hungry. And that really hit her. The next day she's on eHarmony. 2 days later, she's in a hot and heavy texting relationship with a dedicated Christian. So God uses natural means as well as supernatural. Now, these Kenites, remember, Jethro and Reuel are Midianites. They're also called Kenites. I'm not exactly sure what the relationship of Kenite and Midianite is. I forgot it. I'll need to look it up. But anyway, the Kenites are there amongst the Israelites. We read in Judges 4:11, now Heber the Kenite had separated himself from the Kenites from the sons of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses. and it pitched his tent as far away as the oak in Zaninim, which is near Kadesh. That's Kadesh Barnea, which is up in the wilderness of Zin, which is getting right to the south of the promised land. So you got Heber the Kenite. He was of the family of Hobab. He ends up way up there in the north, heading toward Israel. 1 Samuel 15:6, Saul said to the Kenites, "Go depart, go down from among the Amalekites, so that I do not destroy you with them." Well, that's Saul fighting the Amalekites in southern Israel. So that indicates that God kept his promise, or Moses kept his promise. You go with us, you'll be blessed, because they started multiplying in the land of Israel. We now go to Numbers 10, verses 33 through 36, and we will finish up this chapter. Thus they set out from the Mount of the Lord, that's Mount Sinai, 3 days' journey with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord journeying in front of them for the 3 days. Remember, the Ark goes first. 3 days to seek out a resting place for them. The cloud of the Lord was over them by day when they set out from the camp. Then it came about when the ark set out that Moses said, "Rise up, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you." Now, Moses is thinking about enemies. Now, he's going through a desert, but they have no, they're sojourners. They're wanderers in a desert. They're subject to attack. They've loaded up with gold. I mean, the tabernacle itself. How about those 2 silver trumpets? They got lots of wealth. They're carrying through the desert. And they do have a military, but it's never fought before. Well, I can't say that. It's had one battle, I think, with the Amalekites right before they got to Mount Sinai. But it basically, it's in an inexperienced army. And so Moses is thinking about this. God, you have to supernaturally scatter your enemies. If they come after us all at one time, we're going to be toast. Verse 36. When it, that's the ark, came to rest, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the myriad thousands of Israel." Let's start with verse 36. First, when the ark came to rest, Moses said, "Return, O Lord, return, Yahweh, to the myriad thousands of Israel." What does that mean? Well, I think what it means is that when they set the ark back up in the camp in the middle of the 4 triads of the 12 tribes of Israel, when they set that ark up in the middle of all that, he's saying, "Okay, Shekinah glory, you've been leading us out front, now come back and hover over the tabernacle in the center of the camp." John Gill says that, and Benson, the commentator, says this, quote, "Let thy divine presence in the cloud take up its fixed residence over the ark." So I think that's exactly what's happening there. Now this phrase, "let your enemies be scattered," that reminds me of a hymn I used to sing, a song I used to sing about 50 years ago in Christian meetings. Psalm 68:1 quotes it, "Let God arise, let his enemies be scattered, and let those who hate him flee before him." That David used that phrase when he was bringing the Ark of the Covenant from Kiriath-Jearim to Jerusalem. He quoted Moses, "Let God arise, let his enemies be scattered." 2 different contexts of the same phraseology. Now in verse 33, we see that they set out for 3 days' journey. 3 days. It's not likely the first journey covered much territory. Not in 3 days. Why? The NIV Study Bible points out that there were a huge number of Israelites that had to go, and they hadn't practiced going through the desert yet. At least not in an organized military fashion like they're doing now. It's the first time they've carried the tabernacle with them, and that tabernacle, that was nothing easy to do, as we noted as we went through the carrying provisions with the 3 families of the Levites. It was very difficult. Likely, as time went on, they would practice and they would get faster, but right now they haven't gone very far. And that might be an indication that the Paran they went to was not the wilderness of Paran, which is north of the tip of the northern tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, but might be to where that little question mark Paran is, right northwest of Sinai in on BibleAtlas.org. But again, nobody knows. Ladies and gentlemen, I have now finished Numbers chapter 10. We are now prepared to go to Numbers chapter 11, verses 1 through 36. We will see the people complain. They just got started and now they're already griping. And then we're going to see elders appointed to help Moses out with ruling such a fractious mob of people. And then we're going to see the story of quail and a plague. So ladies and gentlemen, I hope you stay tuned with me for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.